Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Carl Davidson, he's the Director of Networking for Democracy, which does work with community organizations, setting them up with computers and other information tech resources, and co-founder of the Third Wave Study Group in Chicago and the magazine SciRev, which is on the web. Welcome, Carl.
I'm glad to be here, Jay.
We've been in touch in the past when I was living in Chicago, but we haven't talked in quite a while, and I see that you're still doing great work out there with these initiatives, trying to bring together egalitarian leftist ideas with high tech, the grappling with the issues of high tech. So tell us a little bit about where the Third Wave Study Group came from. How did it get its origins?
The Third Wave Study Group grew out of a bunch of us who had been working together in various left organizations that were affectionately dubbed the New Communist Movement back in the 70s. A number of us have been very intensively involved in these things. And in the 1990s, when socialism seemed to be collapsing all around the world, a number of us decided that we needed to take a deeper look. It wasn't we felt that a number of our former comrades were just looking at things superficially, attributing this collapse to pressure from the U.S. or corruption from within. And we felt that there was something deeper involved, and that we wanted to go back to the very basics to study to rethink Marxism from the point of view of current developments in science and technology. A number of us were involved in computer professionals in one way or another, and we had a suspicion that information technology had something to do with it. So we started off by a couple of us were familiar with Toffler, Alvin Toffler's work, and we took his book, The Third Wave, and decided to pull together a study group around this book. In addition to having the study group, we decided to also post the dialogue from the study group on the internet and to see if we could get commentary from other people around the world. And that's how it started. And so we called it the Chicago Third Wave Study Group because we were reading Toffler. We had about 15 people involved in the very beginning. And we still have about six of that core group. This is about 6 years ago. And, of course, we've read a lot of books other than Toffler since then. But it's been a very rewarding experience. We're still at it. We think we found some answers to some things, and we don't have the answers to all the questions, but we're trying. We have a few working hypotheses on some others. Anyway, we've developed our own, I call it our own new deviation. We call it cyber Marxism. We have some new and interesting ideas.
Now, one of the things that you're grappling with is the issue of whether automation, the forces of automation, the forces of robotics and so forth, are going to make work less common in the future, and how leftists should deal with that. A lot of left activism historically and currently has been reactionary against the de-skilling of jobs, against the closing down of redundant factories. Think of the British coal miner strike, and many strikes around the world have been about these issues. Is cyber Marxism more embracing of automation, robotics, and these trends that might lead to the previous Marxist vision, which was a world without necessary work, where we weren't enslaved to wage labor?
Very much so. In fact, in one of the first articles we wrote, the manifesto we wrote when we launched, we decided at one point to launch a journal summing up some of our things we were learning in a study group. And we called the journal Sci.Rev. It's on the net at sci.rev.net, CYREV.NET. And you'll find all the past issues there. But anyway, we decided early on that there were two trends in Marxism. One, which, I guess the from the old days, I remember Kim Il-sung from the North Korea being sort of the most extreme example of it, where he had written a pamphlet one time calling for the working classization of everything. And our view, and this was, you know, exemplified in a lot of the trends of the, you know, the traditional left, where, you know, the working class was celebrated as the be-all and end-all, and everything was to be proletarianized. We wanted to proletarianize this and that. I had come from the working class myself, so I escaped some of the romanticism that some of the middle-class intellectuals had about it. And I knew from my own experience, my family's experience, how miserable it was in factories, and how, you know, I remember my uncles and cousins telling me, Carl, you're a little bit, you do well in school. Please, whatever you do with your life, don't go into the mill. It's not a fit place for anybody to work. So that sort of thing always stuck with me. And in my reading of Marx, and in this sense, I think I'm probably more orthodox than those who claim to be. My reading of Marx is that the purpose of, you know, history, his version of it, was to eliminate classes. Mm-hmm. And part of eliminating classes is not just to eliminate the capitalist class. It's to abolish the working class as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my vision, really. It's Marx's, was that, you know, the real goal was human liberation, freeing humanity from toil. I remember back in the 60s, I went to Cuba one time, and we were out on a farm somewhere, and they'd come up with a automatic post-hole digger, and they were just demonstrating it to a bunch of peasants, and this one peasant started jumping up and down and cheering something in Spanish. I didn't speak Spanish. I didn't know what he was cheering, so I asked the translator, and the translator said, he's saying my back is liberated. And that's what he was cheering about. So that was all, you know, that little vignette sort of captured my idea of what the purpose of technology is to liberate us from toil.
Uh-huh.
The kind of vision, we love automation. Now that doesn't mean that there isn't various ways, a bourgeois way and a working class way to approach the question of automation. But we're in favor of automation, and especially the elimination of boring, redundant jobs.
No, but taking that position, and I agree with that position, it puts us in a peculiar situation because there are many social struggles in which our objective analysis is that the bourgeois position is more progressive than the forces that are arrayed against the bourgeois. And so, you know, does it force on us to act in a sectarian way, or to at least try to change people's minds on the progressive left about their values about technology?
I think what we have to ask is, we have to ask of the people who are engaged in these battles a deeper question. What are they really fighting for? It's not that they're fighting to maintain meaningless toil. The workers are fighting because they want to maintain an income.
Mm-hmm.
They're worried about whether they can support their families, whether they have any kind of security. Those are their real concerns. If you could find a way to answer those concerns without having to fight for every backbreaking job, then you begin to approach a solution. So the kinds of demands we would raise, or we would recommend, I would say, within those kind of battles are retraining of the workers in, for the jobs that are being eliminated into new and higher tech jobs, that engage their intelligence and creativity more. And also, for some of the workers who will be laid off no matter what, we argue very much for what is called the social wage. People should have an income, whether or not they have a job. People shouldn't have an income for doing nothing. What we argue for is that anybody who creates value should have an income. And there are many ways of creating value for society that don't entail a traditional blue-collar job. And so we feel that, those are the kinds of broader questions that need to be raised that would draw a distinction between our approach to automation and the bourgeoisie's approach to automation. The bourgeoisie's was just basically just to dump people and let them fend for themselves. And sometimes, the union will fight them, and they'll get some kind of extended severance pay, or even in some cases some minimal retraining. But we want to take that and expand it into something much a broader vision. And that is really, really, in a way, back again, it's really a much more classical position of Marx, not to approach every struggle from the point of view of a trade union secretary, but to approach the struggles with a broader vision that takes into account the whole society and the direction it's going.
I'm speaking with Carl Davidson. He's the director of Networking for Democracy and the co-founder of the Third Wave Study Group and its spawn, the SciRev.net web magazine, which publishes articles on these themes. Now, globalization obviously plays into this, and one of the problematics that traditional Marxist-Leninists usually, and especially Trotskyists, haven't had much problem with, but social democrats have, is the weakness of the nation state, the continuing and ongoing diminution of the role of the nation state as a vehicle for social justice. In other words, that international capitalism holds every nation state hostage to its demands, and that only an international movement of workers and environmentalists and everyone concerned about things that are good and right will be able to meet that challenge. Is there a high-tech road to that kind of international globalization that is distinct from the anti-technology, anti-globalization, isolationist position mm-hmm. that a lot of the left takes?
We like globalization. I tell people I'm a globalizer, and I'm also a free trader. And again, so was Karl Marx.
Right.
But having said that, the question is how do you wage class struggle from that perspective in that context? The traditional left or the trade union approach to it has been to approach it from the point of view of what's been called protectionism. Each group of workers in each country goes out to protect its own jobs and favor legislation that would, protect the things that they produce as opposed to a cheaper version or even a better version of something that was imported from abroad. Our feeling is that that's a dead end. That doesn't lead anywhere positive for the future. Either in terms of the relationship between workers, some of my friends who want to, boycott, I said, well, how many workers in Thailand do you want to lay off today? when you talk about these are our jobs, unemployed Chinese do you want to send back to the farm and say that they can't have proletarian jobs exactly. You need to think through your position on these things a little more broadly. It's not that that we just need to sort of surrender to the capitalist vision of globalization. We have to fight within it for terms that are beneficial to the people rather than a small minority. We're very much in favor, for instance, of the thing of raising the international standards. The idea is to level up all the different standards in terms of, protection on the job, especially the right to organize.
So instead of abolishing the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, this kind of vision would be to reform it and to include more social compacts and agreements and restrictions on unfair trade.
Right. Exactly. And to take it a step further, our feeling is that we really need to make a distinction in this day and age between a different kind of distinction the left has usually made, between corporations. In the past, the left has mainly singled out, we need to make a distinction between monopoly capital and small business, and we can form some kinds of alliances with small business, but to aim the main fire at monopoly capital or large corporations. Our feeling is that that's not very helpful. We cut it a little bit differently. We say the main distinction to be made among the capitalists these days is between speculative capital and productive capital.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes on a global scale. To me, the real, people that we want to isolate or combat in the global arena is not some corporation that wants to sell tractors to peasants in Nicaragua, which is part of productive capital. But the guys who are, you know, betting trillions of dollars on whether the yen goes up or down in the next half hour.
Mm-hmm.
One is pure speculation, and any money that's made from it ends up, you know, devastating, you know, some economy somewhere in the third world, or causing a great deal of harm, or, you know, causing inflation in different places, or unstable currencies. Whereas the other kinds of globalization, where the productive forces are actually expanded, can have a positive impact.
It is one of the great historical ironies, and I'm sure you agree that Russia, the alleged Marxist former Marxist nation, has given rise to one of the greatest historical examples of parasitic kleptocracy.
You've got it. In a way, they have in a concentrated, pure form of a similar process that existed in every other country, that it was much more mixed and took a much longer time.
I mean, you have to look far and wide to find any capitalist in Russia who wants to build anything and be a Model T Ford, Henry Ford kind of guy, you know? It makes
right.
you want to bring back Henry
They
Ford.
All want to get rich quick by just, you know, speculating on the international money markets.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of capital we aim our fire at. We're not, and we don't care whether, you know, even a large corporation, even the largest one like Microsoft, we could find ourselves in a sort of tactical alliance with in any number of ways. If people are doing productive things, either in terms of producing hard goods or producing knowledge, we can find some basis of working with on a global scale. That doesn't mean the class struggle doesn't cease when you're in these kinds of alliances. This is still exists. But we want to aim our main fire at speculative capital. That's sort of our touchstone for.
It's interesting they bring up monopoly capital and Microsoft. Marx was no enemy of monopoly capital. He thought monopolies were great.
To a certain extent, and he's right, because he had a vision of what they led to.
Right.
What they lead to is the growing education, the working class becomes more educated, more capable of running them. The role of the capitalists themselves becomes minimized gradually, because more and more of the work of the corporation or the large network is done by paid managers. And in a sense, it creates the condition for what we would eventually call fully automated, full communism.
I'm speaking with Carl Davidson. He's the director of Networking for Democracy, an outfit in Chicago that he founded to wire up nonprofit organizations and progressive organizations, and the co-founder of the Third Wave Study Group and SciRev magazine at SciRev.net. Now, the perspective, this more complex and complicated perspective that we are talking about vis-a-vis the market and international globalization and so forth, it has to do also with trends in leftist thought, socialist thought, about the role of worker democracy and non-nationalization models of democratization of capital. In other words, market socialism is one of the phrases that's been used. Are you a market socialist? Is this perspective part of market socialism?
Yes and no. I am a market socialist, but only in a transitory sense. I'm really a communist. But I see, socialism as a sort of transition phase, and the role of the market within it. Any socialist economy, any economy that's still based on scarcity is by definition a market economy. Even the ones that are, where everything is completely under command economy, they still have huge black markets in these countries. And the countries would collapse if they didn't have the black markets to work, even under strict top-down command versions of socialism. The market is the way I look at it is the market is an achievement of human civilization. It's not something that's only came into being with capitalism. It predated capitalism, and it'll stick around for a while after capitalism is gone. When people want to abolish the market, they have to remember what the alternative was. Theft, plunder, pillage, these were the things that existed before you had markets.
Mm-hmm. Before you had agreements between people about contracts and who was going to own things and how they were going to be exchanged.
Right.
That's what capitalism is.
Well, in the study group, where we came up, we said every market is a three-sided relationship. a buyer, a seller, and a cop.
To enforce it, exactly.
And, you know, you need, meaning you have to have a state to insert, to defend certain rules, you know, whether it's the weights and measures or something as simple as that, or the ability to sue somebody if they delivered you faulty goods. So you need sort of a referee as well as a buyer and a seller. And that's the truth of any market. That's, in a sense, is our critique of the pure anarchist position. You do need a certain amount of third-party regulation in order for a market to work. Markets are fundamentally based on scarcity. And as long as you have scarcity, you're going to have markets. And if you try to disguise it, you end up with something called a market, but it's not called that. It's a privileged stores for the elite, or it's a black market that goes on under the table. And so our view is let's call things by the right name and put it out there and regulate it in a positive way. Try to harness the dynamic energy of the market, but at the same time to try to civilize it and steer it in certain directions in order to develop the productive forces to the point where we can get economies based on abundance. And once you have an economy based on abundance, the market withers away.
In the last year, I've been participating in various E-list discussions in which there are a lot of libertarians. And, of course, I'm always flame bait for them. But in the last year, I've heard a lot of them discussing Napster and the reactions of the various powers that be to Napster in terms that have forced them into a kind of Bakuninish all property is theft position. You know, they've basically been arguing that any attempt to assert intellectual property rights over software, music, movies, whatever, is a theft from the public commons. Do you think that this is one of the consequences of infotech, that it is making the concept of property more ephemeral and making more naked the commodification and more naked the reaction to commodification in the world?
Well, I think they need to lighten up a little bit. the interesting thing, the debate among Napster and what's really at the core of it is how do you get paid in cyberspace?
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you're dealing with a commodity of a new type. The commodity of a new type is, that's what commodity information is, as opposed to, say, an automobile. If you make an automobile as a commodity, you put it on the market, somebody gives you some money, you give them the automobile, and that's a transaction. The problem with when you have information as a commodity, whether it's in the form of music or WordPerfect programs, you sell the commodity and you have it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
This leads to a sort of loosening up around the edges of what defines the market. And it also leads to with the information technology and computer technology in particular, the copies you make are, number one, unlimited, is the number of copies you can make, and there are fairly exact in the terms of the quality of the copies. So, again, because of information technology, production tends towards abundance, and it tends to drive down the value of it towards zero in terms of the commercial value.
Mm-hmm.
John Perry Barlow, who was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, was one of the best ones to address this when he used the phrase, information wants to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And he meant it in both senses, free in the sense of no restrictions from the state and also free in the sense it doesn't cost anything. And he gave, I think, one of the best examples of the way people need to rethink this question. He gave the example of the Grateful Dead itself. As an answer to the question of how do you get paid in cyberspace.
They allowed everyone to copy their music.
Yes. Not only allowed, they were encouraged to copy their music. And it didn't hurt the Grateful Dead one bit. Because the Grateful Dead had rethought what was it that it was selling. And it was not selling the commodities in the form of music cassettes or records or tapes. What the Grateful Dead was selling was an interaction, a transaction, or an interaction between two people in the form of a Grateful Dead concert. And if any deadheads out there know exactly what I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
There's a quality to experience of the Grateful Dead that when you go to one of their concerts that you couldn't reproduce anywhere, even though you might like their music and listen to it on your tape deck or whatever. There was nothing that could replace the interaction between you and the Grateful Dead at a Grateful Dead concert.
What they saw
is that the free distribution of their music was a form of advertisement for a higher level product that they were selling. And I think that's why people need to look at the Napster thing. Many bands have already said, the fact that their stuff has been reproduced on Napster has increased their sales, increased their public appearances, and has served as a kind of advertising, for getting them more gigs, helping them make more money.
We only have another minute or two, but one of the things that you mentioned about Infotech is that the effect that it has on the market is that it creates the conditions for more perfect information and more perfect competition. And one of the prophecies of Marx was that capitalism would eventually drive its own rate of profit down to zero and increase the immiseration of the working class, and that there would be a global crisis of capitalism as a consequence of that. Do you think that things like eBay, meta shopping programs on the internet and so forth, which I'm a huge fan of, the cost of my book purchases has dropped precipitously in the last two years or so. Do you think that that is, in effect, what Marx envisioned, that the rate of profitability was going to drop? And do you think it's going to contribute to the kind of global capitalist crisis that we imagine?
I think of it in a different way. I think what Marx's prediction was tied to is the fact that as the means of production develop, and by that I mean become thoroughly computerized, and as production less and less human labor becomes involved. The amount of human labor in any given product, living human labor, approaches zero. And when the amount of human labor begins to approach zero, if you hold strictly to the labor theory of value, it means that the value of the commodities begins to approach zero. What's really going on here, again, is a question of abundance. Once things become abundant and the amount of human labor in them approaches zero, you can begin to, the market begins to wither away. You can start distributing things for nothing. That is the positive side of it. Now, the negative side of it is that all of these things don't happen smoothly. Going back to the Luddites, the workers who were thrown out in the streets when their looms were automated, there's a great deal of unevenness and,
the social relations of production have to catch up.
Exactly. And in there you have many fierce battles. You can have many crises. You can have wars between different countries or different regions of the world. I mean, it's not all Ecotopia. It's also Blade Runner out there. It's not necessarily an even ride. There's lots of bumps along the way, but I think the thing to hold on to is Marx's vision of human liberation, liberation from toil, and replacement of it. This doesn't mean people sit around and do nothing, but be engaged in things that are truly meaningful to them, truly creative, and that this is the promise for humanity's future.
I want to really recommend that people check out CyRev, CYREV.net. It's on the web and has an archive of the articles that have come out of the Third Wave Study Group. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, good to talk to you, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. Jay, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.